You know, it just occurred to me this is the last night of spring. When does spring... Is spring over in 45 minutes? 45 lousy minutes. 45 lousy minutes. And spring is over. Yeah, spring. It's over. In 45 minutes. 45 lousy minutes. And then it is summer. And then very shortly thereafter, summer will be over. And then Macy's will celebrate Christmas again. And then, you know, and then there'll be the story about Pearsall signs contract with Mets. And then there'll be four guys released. And then the spring training starts. The whole jazz, the endless cycle over and over and over again. 45 lousy minutes of spring. Now, actually, only 42 lousy minutes of spring left. Or 42 lousy minutes of spring, actually. It is a senseless farrago. Speaking of farrago, that's a fantastic word with which to describe the insensate experience. You know, the farrago. You know what is it, a farrago? A farrago is not a large Italian frog. A farrago is a farrago. It's spelled F-A-R-R-A-G-O. And it's a great definition of life. Now shut up in there, Ed. It's a great definition of life. This is going to go right into the union. Believe me, I got a hotline right into headquarters. Farrago. Will someone please look up farrago for me? It's all right. I want it. Farrago. F-A-R-R-A-G-O. I need it. Because one time, I'll never forget, one of the greatest things that ever happened to me in the world of the theater was one time I was in this, have you ever been in a show so bad that you couldn't even, well, you really couldn't distinguish it or dignify it by calling it a turkey? Because after all, the turkey does have magnificent waffles. There was nothing magnificent about the show at all. And the opening reviewer said, "I have no idea what Mr. Shepard is doing in this shoddy farrago." Well, right about that time, I had no idea what I was doing in that shoddy farrago either. And if anybody has a good dictionary, I think, please let me know what a farrago is. I think it's a great definition of life. You know, speaking of shoddy farragos and the frog, the problem of the frog, since this is the last night of spring, I was listening to the ball game, and I'm sure that a lot of baseball fans suddenly found themselves listening to a ball game instead of watching it on television. It's funny. It sounds more exciting when you listen to it. Are you aware of that, Ed? They're very peculiar because there are long periods when guys are just scratching. When you're watching it on television, they're walking around, they're scratching, and he takes a swing, misses it by a foot, or he just sort of takes a little nub of a swing. Whereas when you're listening to it on baseball, you hear the announcer says, "There's the windup." Uh-oh, wait just a minute now. He pulls back his look towards first now, glances back to second. He's getting a sign. Manoso is digging into the plate. The left-hander winds up. There is the pitch, and it's inside, and Manoso takes a swing, and there's a roller down the third baseline, and you're seeing it all. And actually, what's happened, you know, is a little nubbler, and it's very exciting to listen to. Well, I'm listening to the game tonight. Now, wait a minute. Now, there's continuity here. I'm listening to the game, and suddenly I hear, pew! Somebody throws a gigantic firecracker out near first base, and one blows up near home plate. And Jerry Coleman gets all excited. And I think it's all part of the general atmosphere of violence that is in America in this hot summer. This is a summer that is going to get hotter in many ways, philosophical in a lot of ways. And it's a summer, believe me, people are going to remember this summer before this one is over. And there is an atmosphere. There is something in the air. There is a feeling in the air of a kind of violence. It's really a feeling in the air of sort of yeast is like bubbling, you know. It's bubbling up. Well, the thing is interesting to watch and to be part of. But speaking of the farrago, as we were, the problem of the farrago, which is this wild dance, and this time of the year, it becomes even more evident that we have a tendency to slip into and believe that a certain kind of dream is going to come true. I wonder what it is about summertime that makes people slip into fantasy more than other times of the year. Do you think it has anything to do with heat, climate, one thing or another? Well, now that brings up an interesting point. What about countries where they always have heat? Yes, it is. Well, no, it is quite possible that these countries live most of their lives in a kind of fantasy, a dream world. Have you noticed that most of the hot tropical countries throughout the Caribbean area, these countries are continually having gigantic revolutions, all of which are guaranteed to bring about the millennium, all of which will bring about, if we wait long enough, paradise on earth. Maybe that's part of the fantasy. It's difficult to conceive of a revolution, say, in Sweden, or a giant coup d'etat in Norway. It just doesn't seem to go with it. And I think part of the dream, or the peculiar kind of fantasy that people live in, it depends a great deal on the climate. Now, speaking of fantasy, did you hear this great bit of fantasy, and it's all part of the summer dream, great bit of fantasy that comes out of Jackson, Mississippi. Now, you know what's been happening in Jackson, Mississippi recently. Well, there's been a certain number of statements made by various city officials in Jackson, but the complete statement makes even more of a statement about the summer fantasy and the fantasy of life itself than just the quotes. Listen to this one, Eddie. You better give me some summer music there, the fantasy music. That's great. You want to hear? All of a sudden, I'm in the gigantic shower of life. I'm in the shower, taking a bath. That illustrates it more than anything. Music says it, you know. Already I can hear a little old lady write, "Mr. Shepherd, will you please stop making those maniacal sounds and tell more stories about your boyhood?" Oh, that cake of yeast is a bilin', and it's a sizzlin' and a fizzlin'. Boy, oh boy. Here is the piece of summer madness that we would like to bring to your attention from Jackson, Mississippi. Jackson, Mississippi. And it's from the New York Post correspondent Don Kirk down Jackson, Mississippi, June 14th. There was a certain pathos in the manner in which Mayor Alan Thompson extols the virtues of his city, of Jackson. And we quote him here. "I think this city is the closest place to heaven on earth anyone in the world can be," said the mayor. "Why, when you look at other cities, why shouldn't it be?" Jackson's red-faced mayor, his voice high-pitched and overly insistent after 2 hours of arguing with Negro ministers who somehow didn't share his civic pride, mopped his brow, took a swig of Coca-Cola, and then jumped nervously at the sound of a siren and ran to the window. "You'll just have to excuse me," he said sheepishly upon returning to his seat in City Hall's council chambers. I just get scared every time I hear them things these days. Now, the question is, could it be that the hot, sultry climate of Jackson, Mississippi has addled the dream? And I'm sure that the mayor really does believe that, quote, "I think this city is the closest place to heaven on earth anyone in the world can be. Why, when you look at other cities, why shouldn't it be, is what I say." Speaking of madness, this is WOR AM and FM, New York. Oh, yeah. The summer madness is slowly settling in. And it can be found on all sides. It takes many forms. And, for example, there is the form that always happens just when we're going from spring into summer, or really from winter into spring. And that's the kind of madness that says, "I will shake off the bounds. I will shake off those shackles and chains of the old rotten fat me. And I will become this sylph-like bronzed creature, running and running and running and running forever in the sunlight, arms outstretched, arms reaching for arrows." Oh, it takes many forms. And they find expression. On the one hand, the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, says, "I think this is close to heaven as you can be down here." And outside the window, you hear, the emergency sound of the sirens and the horns going past, and people hollering and stones pelting through the windows. "I believe this just as close to heaven and paradise as one can be." And then, for example, just in a recent, very recent issue, this is typical of the kind of summer madness and the peculiar sort of dream that's enveloping a large portion of American life, a kind of dream that that one day will be very hard to remember. You know, I think a lot of us, 20 years from now, when history has run its course, or at least the tide of history has reached a certain point, and the great sweeping, obviously sweeping changes that are taking place in American life, and in fact the world, this is not just an isolated popping out of a thing in one country. I think this is a great sweeping changes in the history are in the making right now. It's going to be hard, Ed, to look back on this summer, and in fact this time, and to recall how it really felt. Yes, I'm serious about that. It must have been very difficult for a historian. Of course, historians is difficult because historians they hardly ever record their time. Most historians are busy now plowing the Civil War battlefields over and over and over again, endlessly, which is another kind of fiddling, while Rome is doing what Rome always does. I just wonder if 100 years or so from now, maybe less than that, let's take 75 years from now, let's take 50 years to be more on the safe side, there will be a lot of people still alive who are alive now, who are very young now. I wonder if they will be able to explain how it felt to be around at this time, the kind of peculiar escapism that began to sweep over America, like the almost maniacal interest in the Mets. It was a very interesting kind of escape. And the strange, almost violent overtones that this escape takes. I've been going to ballparks for many years, and I have never seen the odd kind of... Well, it is a kind of violence that is evidenced often at the polo grounds. A peculiar kind of irrational marching that I think is all part of it. I don't think any one part of our world can escape the overall, the zeitgeist, you know, the air, the atmosphere. And a couple of sessions ago, for example, this will probably turn out to be a kind of nutty classic of the dream, in a way, this piece, but a piece in Glamour magazine here a couple of months back. And the headline, I think, is in itself a kind of statement of that escape. It just simply says, "It's going to be a romantic summer." Yes, it's going to be a romantic summer. Summer, the very word, sounds a romantic echo. It summons the senses, breathing an awareness of color, of light, of the smell of honeyed air, the feel of hot sand. It arrives ethereal as twilight, physical as a blistering game of tennis. It is at once endless and ephemeral, paradox that symbolizes the romantic. Endless to a child, too quickly over for a grown-up. A story opens. The summer I was 18, and one feels something magic, nostalgic, infinitely tender is about to unfold. I do not buy the Southern novelist's summer of madness and murder. My summer's madness leads to love. Summer is to glory, wallow in, drink to the hilt, a season for laughs, a season that is thoroughly nice. It is no time, in truth, for resolutions, but resolve anyway. Once upon you, summer, like romance, dissolves intentions, eludes programs, upsets plans. Resolutions must be taken, absorbed, and forgotten long before the hot days come. So set the framework now, for then, when summer comes. Resolve. To have done with climbing, to do your self-improving, your growing as a child does his studying, in the winter and spring, and in the summer to bask in the fruits of accomplishment, the sensual pleasures of life. Women who have no summers in their lives, look it. To defrost a heart numbed by a winter disappointment, a lost love, a defeat, to allow it at the risk of being hurt, to be touched and to melt. To stretch time by absolving life of unwanted detail, unnecessary appointments, to tear up schedules, to do without wearing a watch, to say no to the unwanted, uninvited guest, to say yes to the spur-of-the-moment invitation, to move lightly, and to speak gently, and to absolutely, absolutely stop worrying about anything.
Yes, I believe this city's just about as close to paradise as heaven is wanting to get. Then he wanted to get. Yes, I believe that too, actually.
Resolved to work during the air-conditioned week crisply, efficiently, with detached fury, at a coolly tidy desk, and on the weekend to keep work from your mind, and then to stretch cat-like in the sun. To run your house the same way, cat-like stretched in the sun. To lose yourself in something physical. To storm a sport, battle the waves, wildly gallop across the pasture on a horse you trust. To run down a hill, up a beach so fast and so free that you wonder why, with the smallest leap, you couldn't fly. To practice the piano and to play with turbulent passion and renewed accuracy those pieces that sound like the breaking sea, the revolutionary etude, the last movement of the Moonlight Sonata. To learn to play cool jazz. To listen to music which reaches high, high, high up, to catch that unbearably beautiful note, Beethoven's seventh, the third act of Der Rosenkavalier, the horn concertos of Mozart, Miles Davis playing Porgy and Bess. Resolve from time to time to invoke solitude, and with it, the spirit. Invoke them on a beach, standing in a mountain stream, with a park bench lunch, in a window seat, to read mythology, and spot the stars and constellations, and to find a view you will never tire of.
to paint something bright red, a picture, a chair, a room. Well, a small room. The town. Ha ha! Your mouth. Yes, to wear a pair of bright red shoes and to dance and to dance and to dance and to dance all summer long. Yes, to make up a children's story and then to meet an artist on the beach and tell him about it. To hear him then say to you, "But how marvelous. I would like to illustrate it." And the dance of the pie and pie, and not once worry all summer. To try your hand at a piece of pop art. Paint a bin of fresh fruit coal black, and then send it with greetings to the Museum of Modern Art. Yes, girls, to invent a new art form, pop poetry. Resolve to read romantic poetry to yourself aloud. Not capital R romantic, the optimistic, the beautiful, the brave, sentimental poems of Keats and Shelley, but the poetry that strikes you girls as romantic. For instance, the bittersweet love verses, more attuned to our time, of the 17th century metaphysical poets Herrick, Vaughan, Marvell, Crashaw. To sing this tune of Don's, go and catch, girls, a falling star. Get with child a mandrake root. Tell me where all past years are, or who cleft the devil's foot. Teach me to hear mermaids singing, or to keep off envy stinging, and find what wind serves to advance an honest mind. And then to sit and read these lines from Herrick, our life is short, and our days run as fast away as does the sun, and as a vapor or a drop of rain, once lost can ne'er be found again. And then to note, cheery afterthought, that he lived in an age when poets dropped like flies to the ripe old age of 83. Resolve to fall in love, girls, with a man, a place, with a child, with a movie star, with an animal, or with one perfect day. To fall in love lightly in June and deeply in August. To make love. To up and get married. And if you upped, and if you upped and did it 10 summers earlier, to dissolve time, to go back just for a week to that summer, those two people, to beware of men wearing smoke goggles, deep purple tans, cunningly knotted silk scarfs, white ducks, black polo shirts, espadrilles, driving shiny red Mercedes. Yes, and to take to your heart a man wearing real, honest-to-goodness sunburn, sneakers, khakis, a clean, threadbare blue shirt, no tie, no scarf, hand-knit sweaters, riding like Tony Perkins on a bicycle. Resolve to read, if you never have, these brief, passionate novels. The Wanderer by Alain Fournier, The Good Soldier by Ford Madox Ford, The Return of the Soldier by Rebecca West, The Vagabond by Colette. To read the books that fit your summer. Durrell's The Alexandria Quartet for a certain kind of city summer. Chicago with its towers, its esplanade, its flat, endless blue sea, its mosquitoes, its steamy nightlife, its, well, it could be Alexandria. To the lighthouse for the sea summer. To Kill a Mockingbird for the small town summer. Tender is the night for any summer. Resolve to lose 5 pounds. Da, 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 da. To find a lost disposition, a lost sense of humor. To go for an entire week without being cross, without frowning, without cursing. But should you be moved to do so, to cry. To picnic on a lonely beach one gray, chilly day. To picnic along the roadside some warm, balmy night. To treat life a bit like a movie that you have suddenly walked into. A dream in which you are both viewer and participator. To play act. To allow illusion to color reality. To keep a diary. A diary you truly wouldn't want to see on the front page of the New York Times. A diary of gossip and passion. Yes, sir, you just straighten up and pull in your gut and have yourself a great summer, Cal. Now, who's nuttier, the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, or Glamour? And all the while, you know, I keep seeing little fat ladies with pimples in apartments where all the air conditioning unit does is spit on them, sitting there with their bottle no Cal. Okay, Macy's Bureau of Standards. The madness is... Oh, yeah, have you seen the madness? Here's another one. Come on, you whip me up. Are you a madcap? Do you yearn to wade in fountains, drive a handsome cab, haggle with Tiffany, wear green slacks to pink tees, sing along with Sutherland, roller skate up Fifth Avenue, lead a lynx on a leash, demand bagels and lox at the Forum of the Twelve Caesars? Then, madcap, this scamp wig is you, utterly you, 100% human hair, only $69 at Wig City. Oh, boy, that's going to be filed into my decline and fall file, Ed. So that 1,000 years from now, they're going to know. It's funny, though, walking along, and in the city, of course, summer is one thing. It is, to those of you who are living, who live outside, perhaps you're not aware of it, but those of you who listen in the city, but WOR, at this hour of the night, roughly covers about 25 or 30 states, and it is pretty hard to comprehend for a person, say, living in Nova Scotia. I get a lot of mail from Nova Scotia. Just how abstract and how, to many people, that kind of summer that was outlined by Glamour magazine sounds perfectly logical. As a matter of fact, you find thousands of people in New York attempting and always failing, of course, because of the reality of life, like you cut your foot. Always failing to find that you can run along endlessly along the beach without stepping on beer cans. They never mention that, you know. The realities of life are, and again, I must say that you can only really define a dream, a living dream, by the terms that a living dream represents a fantasy wherein none of the laws of natural nature ever take any effect, like beer cans on the beach, like cigar butts in the sandwiches, like not losing 5 pounds because you're running free on the beach and eating a hot dog as you run. These things they never take into account that getting to the beach, you spend 2.5 hours in a gigantic traffic jam along Queens Parkway somewhere, and your car boils over, and there's a fist fight when you finally get out there with the guy you're with or with the girl you're with, and you get up and there's 4,500 juvenile delinquents throwing beer cans at everybody else in the parking lot, and a guy's been sick all over the back of the convertible when you get back to your car. None of these things are ever taken into account, you know, which happens. Not only happens, it is life. I'm beginning to suspect that large numbers of novelists, for example, are becoming, because of being sucked into this dream, are becoming sick and tired of life itself. But they can't ever admit that.
And so they have to ascribe all these things, like guys getting sick on the back of the convertible and beer cans being thrown at them, as somehow a plot against them, a plot by insensate mankind, or a plot that is being perpetrated by the unfeeling, unsensitive type people, or just the system. That's even better. Just call it the system. And so they wind up by writing these non sequitur type novels, where the hero wanders through observing all the ridiculousnesses of life and implying, of course, that none of them apply to him, that all of these insanities and these inanities and these weaknesses in mankind are there and could be corrected and just could be wiped out by right thinking. Well, I don't know what right thinking is going to do about the guy who gets sick on the back of the convertible or the beer can that gets you on the back of the neck when you're in Section 17 out at the Polo Grounds. I'm not so sure that much can be done about that, because this is the texture of existence itself. I always admire people who understand that life consists of this stuff, as well as the few brief fleeting moments of passion or joy or the delirious feeling of Sartori, or the feeling of being with it, the feeling of sudden transcendental understanding, but all the rest of it is part of it too, and it's inescapable. It's always been that way, and will always be that way. And I'm sure that the mayor, running to his window, looking out and hearing the sound of the sirens in Jackson, Mississippi, looks upon this as some kind of a nutty plot, that's not the real world out there, that the real world is the world where the big sign says, Paradise on Earth, Jackson, Mississippi. Rotary meets on Wednesdays, every other Wednesday in Pfeiffer's Garage. You know, this is the real world to him, and the real world is around his swimming pool or at his country club. That's the real world. The sound of those sirens is totally unreal. It's a very, very, it's a real problem. And when you hear guys talking in Congress, and you hear talk going back and forth, and you just can see the fantasy going on. I heard a senator the other day when he was being interviewed about what he thought about all the new social legislation that Kennedy has proposed. His reply went roughly like this: "Well, I'll tell you this. I stand for freedom, and I'm going to tell you I'm going to filibuster. I'm going to filibuster against that bill. If it takes me all year, I'm going to work against that bill, because I believe in freedom, you know, and I believe in the American way of life, and I think that we have a great danger here of a totalitarian kind of thing coming in, and I believe that you just can't tell people what to do." And he went on and on, and I had a feeling that here is another section of the dream. You know, it's a strange thing. It must have been that way at any given time in history, when great, vast, all-encompassing, and irreversible social changes were coming into being. And those who had committed themselves to something earlier and were not aware of the changing atmosphere in the world, that the dream was part of the sense of that we can turn back, we can quit all this, cut out all the nonsense and return to real honest to John sense. It's so sad to hear senators get up and say things like, and get great followings too, senators who say things like, I believe what we ought to do is just, we ought to campaign for victory against the communists. We ought to just reverse all these things that have been happening in the last 50 years, all these ridiculous socialist... And what they say is let's all sit under the apple tree and dream that it's 1874. Let's all get together and make a gigantic Western, and we'll all be parts, and we'll have all of us will wear our hats and gallop around in an imaginary countryside composed of a gigantic Western TV film. If you look at our television shows going on hour after hour after hour, there has never been, as far as I know, and perhaps with the possible exception of Rome in its last days, there has never been a nation so devoted to escapism of one kind or another, one form or another, as we are at this point. And escapism, of course, takes many, many forms. It takes some of the forms are so subtle that it's even hard to put your finger on. And you find yourself doing it. You find yourself plunging into all kinds of things, sudden activities that
There probably are more people today collecting 19th century salt shakers than ever before, diligently devoting all their time to that. You'd be surprised that whenever I mention a thing like this on the air, I'm deluged immediately with all kinds of letters from people saying, "Dear Mr. Shepherd, I'm a constant listener of yours, and whenever you start getting serious and talking about things, social critic, just absolutely boring, I just yawn. Now, I'm a college graduate myself. I went to a good college, and I know about all this. And I just yawn. Why don't you just stick to the thing you do best, like tell those wonderful yarns about when you were a boy?" Signed, an almost disgusted listener. Now, remember, I love you, and I listen to everything you say, and I just love everything you do, but you just bore the daylights out of me when you tell me about these things that are happening, because they're just boring, boring, boring. Now, you just tell me about when you were a kid and had a Cracker Jack there. And hour after hour, until I find out, and I say, sure, I'm a very inadequate chronicler of our time. I'm the first to admit that. But then I look around and find that nobody is chronicling it. Nobody is saying, and I don't have the sense of being a voice in the wilderness. I just say, when is somebody going to say that we are in as profound a change, a movement, a great shift in the world as must have happened at the time the Dark Ages gave way to the Renaissance? There's a current article in Life magazine about college dropouts. Well, I want to say this about college dropouts. Unfortunately, I think that the article implies that this is because of bad home life, something's wrong with the kids. No, I don't believe that at all. I believe that a whole way of life, and that includes a whole education, is now practically invalid. And some people recognize it in college and don't know why it's invalid. They don't know why they're bored. They don't know why it has no meaning to them to sit hour after hour conjugating Latin verbs. They don't know why they don't find it significant in their lives to spend day after day reading statistics of the Civil War, going through English literature from Thomas Hardy to Beowulf in two semesters of survey. And we, many people who have gone through that and are committed to it, committed to that way of life and committed to that kind of education and so on, think that those who are not are some kind of kook, and that they're some kind of sick person, and that they're letting everybody down. And yet it must have been that way. Do you know that before, are you aware that before the Renaissance, during the Middle Ages, there were great universities that had enormously involved courses and whole structures of philosophy that are today totally obsolete. Not one person ever studies them, and yet there was a whole world committed to that stuff. Do you know that there was an entire world, for example, of study committed to alchemy? And I'm sure that a man who was 84 years old, who had been trying to make lead into gold and was grinding up frogs, bat's wings all of his life, could not understand when his kid, after studying alchemy for 2 years, somehow something in the atmosphere told him, "No, get away, kid. It's not going to work." And he ran out into whatever world he was in, and his old man says, "Come, thou art a knave. Thou art insane, and that the evil spirits have touched him." Well, I'm of the belief that something much greater than just a passing madness is now taking place, and I'm not so sure that it's a madness. That's something too that probably sounds to many people perhaps even subversive, but one doesn't know what one is involved in until long after history has made its statement about it. It's an intriguing thing we're living through, and you know, speaking of the summer madness, I remember one time I'm walking around in the city here, and there were a group of people. This was about 3 or 4 weeks ago, standing on a street corner, and I was walking past them, and I came up, and I looked. I wondered what it was. They were all looking down on the curb. They were looking down in the gutter. And they were looking down. I walked over to see what they were looking at, and they were looking at a frog. A frog had gotten somehow on 23rd Street. Well, everybody around there was out of their skull. They were fascinated. You know, they're poking them, and some people were going to hit them, and they were going to step on them and yelling. And frogs are very scary to people who ride in cabs all of their lives. Oh yes, that's why I prefaced all this with pointing out to those who are living in the outer precincts that it's hard for you to understand the kind of abstract life that people in the city think is existence. And yet, on the other hand, you probably are not aware at all, and this is why so many of the great social changes somehow bypass the country, that from the city and the peculiar abstract madness that is urban life, from the urban life always springs the great social revolutions, that all the great movements in history sprang from packed people all together with hot summer sun beating down on them. And it springs up almost like spontaneous combustion, you know. It springs up all over the world. It doesn't just spring up in one place at one time. Do you know there's a lot of interesting theories about the universality of the sudden spontaneous creation of an idea? Are you aware that they have tracked this down, that all over the world simultaneously dozens of men will have the same original idea? Why? Well, theories about that, too. It's time for the idea, some people say. It's the air. It's the atmosphere. Some people are touched by the atmosphere, and others are not. Usually the young are completely controlled by it. The zeitgeist of a time. Because they're not committed to a previous time. The older people are deeply rooted in a time past, and they judge all times present by times past, and they're just totally invalid, completely. That the alchemist would have a devil of a time judging, Oppenheimer today. Very difficult. I wonder whether they'd even have anything to talk about. I wonder if anybody has anything to talk about, really, ultimately.